Henry Aaron has always been known as, will always be known as, Hammerin' Hank, the man and brave that many people still consider the real leading career home run hitter of all time. But Henry Aaron never liked that name, or what he thought it implies. A new biography has just been published, The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. The author is our friend and sports voice on this program, Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine. He joins us from New York. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And you open with this really unforgettable scene of Henry Aaron at a sports memorabilia convention. And, you know, people talking about, oh, I was here when you hit number 715 to break the record. And thinking they're getting on his good side. But you offer another view.
Yes. Well, one thing that's very interesting about Henry Aaron is that there is this great gap between Hank Aaron, public figure, home run hitter, and Henry Aaron, human being. And I think one thing that's very interesting about him is that it's not uncommon with professional people and superstars to have a private side and a public side, naturally. But the gap between his was so great. Mm-hmm. And the night of April 8th, 1974, when he broke Babe Ruth's record, was not a joyous time for him. It was joyous for the fans who wanted to see him succeed, but for him it was not a happy moment at all.
Yeah, that was a difficult time for him. He was under a lot of pressure, and not just pressure.
Well, I think the thing for him that's very difficult for him to reconcile is this notion that something was taken from him that he could never get back. And the only reason that this wasn't a joyous occasion was because he was an African American. And the irony of it all is that during his moment, which was not very joyous, and then 33 years later when Barry Bonds broke his record, also a moment that was not joyous for the country for other reasons based on the steroid era, it was Henry Aaron that the baseball public wanted to turn to remind it of its values. And I think that it was a collision or a conflict that Henry was never quite sure how he felt about. And I think it's a very interesting moment for him now, because I know there's a part of him that is thinking, well, where were you in 1974 when it was my turn?
How do you explain the rivalry between Willie Mays and Henry Aaron? I mean, all team rivalries aside, pro players know they could be teammates tomorrow, and rivalries tend to be personal rather than across team lines.
I think Henry Aaron admired Willie Mays as much as he admired any ball player not named Jackie Robinson. He had always said in interviews how much he admired Willie, how much he loved Willie's skills and Willie's electricity, and was in a lot of ways, I wouldn't say envious, because I don't think he took a backseat to anybody as a hitter, mm-hmm. but he certainly loved Willie's game. And as his career...
But Willie Mays is arguably the greatest outfielder of all time.
The best five-tool player ever in terms of being able to do everything well. And I think that Willie truly was a hero of Hank Aaron's. But on the other side, I think that it was very difficult for Willie Mays. The narrative for Willie Mays had always been that he was going to be the one to break Babe Ruth's record. He was going to be the one who challenged Ruth. But Mays' career slowed down, and Aaron's picked up by the late 1960s. And by 68, 69, 70, it was very clear that it wasn't going to be Mays. It was going to be Henry Aaron who had the chance to challenge Ruth. And I think that Henry was such a proud man and so sure of his accomplishments that I think what he wanted Willie to do was just to say congratulations. And it was very hard. And I could imagine that it would be hard for anybody when you're that good for that long to have to give up the spotlight.
To complicate that, your book throws yet another spotlight on the years in which Barry Bonds of the San Francisco Giants, by the way, the godson of Willie Mays, is advancing on Henry Aaron's all-time home run record, and Henry Aaron had, to say the least, complex thoughts.
Well, the hard part with the Henry Aaron story in general has always been that he's always been compared to someone else throughout his career. He was compared to Mays when he came up. And then as he challenged the record, he was compared to Ruth. And now that his record was being challenged in 2006 and 2007, ultimately, he was now being compared to Barry Bonds. And for me, the question had always been, why can't we look at this man on his own terms? Why can't we assess him on his own terms? Why does he always have to be part of this unfavorable comparison to another player. And during 2007, when the record was broken, Henry Aaron decided that there was no way he could win in this comparison. Mm-hmm. If he had come out and said that he was in support of Barry Bonds breaking the record, then he was giving tacit approval to the use of steroids and performance-enhancing drugs, since Bonds was caught up in that controversy. And if he came out against Barry Bonds, then he would look like a bitter old man who didn't want to see his record broken. So his conclusion was I'm going to say nothing. I'm going to just let history decide. And ultimately, he ended up winning even more respect from the public because he was the person who maintained his dignity. Barry Bonds may be the record holder now, but Henry Aaron is the standard bearer, and that's much more important today.
Yeah. Howard, you're a man who uses words carefully. Why do you call Henry Aaron a hero?
I call him, not only do I call him a hero, I call him the last hero. And that title is not just for effect. I think one of the reasons why I was drawn to this book in the first place was because of my second book, Juicing the Game, was about the steroid era. And obviously, when you're dealing with that era, you begin to wonder about the value systems of this country and of the game and of what stands for cheating and what does it mean to do things the right way. And as I found out over 2005 and 2006, it wasn't just the steroids. It's the housing crisis, and it was Enron, and it was this feeling that the only thing that matters is to accumulate as much money as you possibly can, and nobody cares how you got it. And I began to think, especially in baseball, when they have this the saying, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. And I really was offended by that. And I began to think about not just the game, but who was I interested in? Who did I think represented these values of accountability and integrity and such that seemed quaint today? And it was Henry Aaron, because he wanted to be a person of substance. He didn't just want to be a baseball player. His record, the home run record, was the last record that wasn't tainted by drugs.
Did Henry Aaron cooperate with you?
That's a very good question, Scott. It took 2 years for Henry Aaron to agree to talk to me about this book. I started to work on the project in May of 2006, and we did not speak, ironically, until Jackie Robinson's birthday, January 31st, 2008. And I spent a lot of time trying to convince him that I was interested in the full sum total of his life as an American icon, as a person that I respected. And I remember the first time that we had spoken, he had said, nobody cares. Nobody cares about the fact that I raised five children or the fact that I was trying to use my baseball celebrity to create a foundation to help young people. They only care about what I hit on a 3-2 pitch or which home run I hit off of which pitcher or what I have to say about steroids. And I said to him, Mr. Aaron, do you honestly believe that that's what you think the public feels about you? And he said, yes, because that's all that people ask me. And I said, well, sir, I'm calling for your blessing because I would like to do a little bit more than that. And he agreed. It was not an authorized biography. He never asked me for a dime. He never made the phone call that all biographers hate, which is to say, hey, this guy's doing a book on me. Don't talk to him. He let me into his life as much as he could. And I was very, very thankful for that.
Howard Bryant, his new book, The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. Thanks so much, Howard.
Thank you.
Next week, the Obama White House will host its second state dinner, and this time, in honor of Mexico's President Felipe Calderon, the chef will be Chicago's Rick Bayless, winner of America's Top Chef, multiple James Beard Awards, and the man who, through his restaurant books and appearances, has transformed Mexican food into a four-star cuisine. Chef Bayless joins us now from Los Angeles. Rick, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Scott.
The Obamas know your place, don't they?
They do. They were regular customers before they moved to Washington.
So how did this come about? You get a phone call one day saying, could you make dinner for 200 people at the White House, and one of them is the president of Mexico?
Yes, actually we did. That's the way it went down. And it was a pretty astonishing moment for me.
New York Times says there's going to be a mole to beat the band on the menu. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's an interesting thing to me because obviously most people in the United States still think of Mexican food so much in terms of the simple street foods like tacos and such. And I certainly wanted to feature something that I consider to be Mexico's greatest dish. So, yes, I'm going to be making a mole, and I think it's got 27, 28 different ingredients in it.
I guess a lot of people know that we're friends. And
yes.
And you believe in locally grown ingredients, including from your own garden.
That's exactly right.
Can you schlep anything from your garden to the White House?
Oh, no, that's the hardest part. There's no ingredient that we're going to be bringing from home. The biggest challenge for me is to actually create the food that we do in our restaurants in the White House kitchen. I think there'll probably be aromas in that kitchen that have never been there before.
Well, and that's the point of it, isn't it, come to think of it?
I'm hoping so.
Have you seen the kitchen?
I've never seen the kitchen before, and it's going to be really a remarkable
experience. Didn't you watch West Wing?
I never watched West Wing, and I don't know if it would have even been an accurate description of what it is. But I have to say that I've seen pictures of it, and I know that it's very well equipped. And we've talked with Chris Comerford, the chef there.
Yeah.
And she has assured us that we'll have everything that we need to create our moles and ceviches and all that sort of stuff. So I feel like that I'm in really, really good hands.
Rick, isn't it true in the White House kitchen there always has to be a taster on duty to taste the stuff before it goes out?
I'll tell you afterwards. I have never cooked there before, so I don't really know.
Seems to me, I read that, and I raise the issue now because if there's one job in the executive branch for which I am qualified, it would be to be your taster.
I would certainly welcome that. Well, we'll have to put your name on the list.
Rick Bayless is chef of the Frontera Grill at Topolo Bampo in Chicago and creator of Frontera Gourmet Foods. Thanks so much, Rick.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Scott.
This is NPR News. I got to interview Scott Turow this week at the S. Dillon Ripley Center of the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. The audience was standing room only. After all, Washington, D.C. has a lot of lawyers and fans of Scott Turow's novels. He has a new one out, Innocent, the sequel to Presumed Innocent, the 1987 bestseller that made Scott Turow one of the major writers in America. Innocent picks up the story of Rusty Savage. 22 years after being acquitted of murdering a colleague with whom he'd had an affair, he's the chief judge of the appeals court, but one morning he wakes up to find his wife dead in bed beside him. Once again, Rusty Savage is accused of murder. Scott Turow is not a lawyer-novelist. I read down the list of his bona fides for the audience.
Scott taught creative writing at Stanford, then went to Harvard Law School. But he wasn't so busy in that heralded pressure cooker that has been known to reduce magna cum laude's to sobbing wrecks that he didn't have time to write his first book, 1L. In the U.S. Attorney's Office in Northern Illinois, he prosecuted federal judges and a former Illinois Attorney General before becoming one of the most successful novelists in the world. But he also continues to take cases pro bono, including winning the release of an innocent man who spent 11 years on death row. He served on the Governor's Commission to reform the death penalty, and on the seventh day, Scott Turow rests. Now, 23 years later, he has written Innocent, and we're so glad to welcome him.
Thanks, Scott,
for letting me do this.
Thank you.
I'm not going to ask you why write a sequel, because that's a little bit like asking Steve Jobs, why do you keep coming up with another iPhone? But why now?
There's no good answer to that, except that, you know, he had an idea. And, you know, sometime in 2005, you know, the last child left home, I was probably in a contemplative mood with 60 somewhere nearby. And I'd had this weird little post-it note on my desk, which said, "A man is sitting on a bed in which the dead body of a woman lies." And where the image came from, I can't really tell you. I think there's a Hopper painting of a woman sitting on a bed. And I turned around one morning after it had been sitting there a couple of months and suddenly said to myself, that's Rusty Savage who's sitting on that bed.
Are you always plotting murders in your mind?
No, you know, these people just end up dead. And it's up to me to explain it.
You have an innocent, the murder at the heart of this one involves a chemical reaction to salami, cheese, and red wine. It may already be too late for a lot of you who are here tonight.
Many of my favorite foods.
So is that true?
Yeah.
The chemical reaction?
Yeah. Deuteramines, right. Yeah.
So how do you come up with interesting and more or less untried ways to murder people?
Well, this one actually just involved a lot of consulting. I talked to a toxicologist named Jerry Lakin and a pathologist, Michael Kaufman, and I would just tell him what I needed. I needed, you know, a death that could be mistaken for natural causes, and I described what ailments the victim had, and they would give me suggestions. And finally, I found a pill that had been suggested that looks just like a common household pharmaceutical. And I was eureka, that's it. I know just how this crime's going to occur.
As we mentioned, you still practice law.
Till I get it right, the old challenge.
Does the client-attorney privilege ever overlap with the novelist-client privilege?
In what sense?
Well, novelists absorb everything, right?
Right.
I mean, they're somebody here who's a 65-year-old man might be initially, maybe in a small way, based on someone you went to nursery school with.
Well, I don't tend to write well with one-to-one correspondence from life, but, you know, there's a detail in Innocent, which I will allow to go unmentioned, that I picked up from a case, but the case was more than 20 years ago. And I know the people who were involved in the case will smile when they see it. But, you know, that's about as close as I'll get.
Mm-hmm. And why do you still practice law?
You know, I always say, and I mean it, that the great break of my literary career was when I went to law school. Mm-hmm. It gave me a subject that I was passionate about, that, you know, I still find as interesting as I did the day I entered law school. And, you know, I think lawyers can do good things. Now, every lawyer would like to practice under the terms that I practice. There's no economic pressure. I take the cases I want to take and turn away the others. So it's no real facsimile of law practice for the many lawyers who, you know, labor hard. But being a lawyer, even in a city as large as Chicago, is like being a citizen of a small town. I love watching the life of the town play out. You know, the rise and fall of individual lives and the entire community is just fascinating to me.
But if you'd stayed at Stanford in the creative writing program, you
might
have wound up writing vampire novels?
I don't know what I would have ended up writing. I probably would have ended up writing what I was writing then, unpublished novels.
A lot of lines in Innocent just stopped me cold. I wrote one in particular I want to ask you about.
Okay.
When love is involved, you can give only so much ground to propriety or even wisdom. How did you learn that?
Can I pass on this one?
Yes, of course.
I'm a single person, and I've done a lot of learning late in life, so I'll leave it at that.
Let's invite your questions. We have, yes, sir.
I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about the whole process of your novel, your first novel, becoming being made into a movie, and then how that has sort of influenced this novel. Mm-hmm. To what extent? I mean, I'm sure you had a very clear idea of who Rusty Savage was when you wrote Presumed Innocent, but now is it does he look like Harrison Ford?
Well, I think one of the blessings that I've had in watching, you know, films be made now from four of my books is to realize that it's a separate thing. It's a separate work. You know, I really believe that the movie will never be as good as the book, both because the book goes on longer. A movie is basically an abridgment of a book. And because books are internal. but they are incredibly powerful. The visual format is, you know, amazing. And it's true that after Harrison played Rusty Savage so well, when I thought about Rusty Savage, I saw Harrison's face. One of the neat things was that as I began writing Innocent, Harrison's face started to fade away, and I saw Rusty Savage again in the way I had seen him, you know, 25 years ago when I was writing Presumed Innocent.
I actually have two questions I'd like to wind up with. Do you have any worries about the survival of the novel?
The truth is, I have no worries whatsoever about the survival of the novel. Whether the audience for the novel will be as large as it is now, I think is pretty much told already, you know, by history. But the experience of reading fiction is so immediate and moving to so many people that I am not worried about whether the novel will survive. It will survive, and certainly I'm not about to stop, so they'll have to stop me.
What's your favorite lawyer joke?
Three people are sitting on a park bench. They're an engineer, a doctor, and a lawyer. And the engineer says, "It's obvious to me that God was an engineer. Look at the remarkable precision of everything in nature." And the physician speaks up and he says, "But look at the extraordinary intricacy of all the life forms on Earth. It's obvious that God was a physician." And the lawyer says, no, you're both wrong. God was a lawyer. He created chaos and darkness first."
Scott Turow, recorded in front of a live audience earlier this week at the S. Dillon Ripley Center of the Smithsonian Institutions in Washington, D.C. Scott's new book, Innocent, is the sequel to his 1987 novel, Presumed Innocent. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, broadcasting this week from NPR West in Southern California. Below the surface of the Gulf of Mexico is a giant pool of oil, at least as large as Delaware, and quite possibly much bigger. Now, imagine areas of the ocean where a thick blob is suspended in the water, all life above and below potentially strangled. Now, this scenario is what some scientists are starting to fear. And in a few moments, we'll hear from one who says we simply don't know how bad it is. Here's what we do know at this hour. BP, the company that leased the Deepwater Horizon, says it hopes to begin siphoning off that oil soon by inserting a mile-long hose right into the well. Here's Doug Suttles, BP's chief operating officer, earlier today.
We're in the process of running the riser insertion tube. This is the method to contain the flow. This doesn't stop the flow. We hope to have that tool inserted by sometime late tonight.
The Obama administration is now demanding clarification from BP after reports that the company is sending mixed signals over who should pay for the cleanup. Earlier this week, NPR reported that both government estimates and BP's own estimates about the size of the spill are likely way off by an order of magnitude. Here's Professor Stephen Worley from Purdue University.
We're talking more than a factor of 10 difference between what I calculate and the number that's being thrown around.
That could mean an Exxon Valdez-sized spill every 4 days. Meanwhile, the Coast Guard is shooting chemical dispersants deep under the water, close to the source of the spill. And no one quite knows what kind of environmental impact it'll have. Our coverage of the spill begins with NPR's Elizabeth Shogren along the Louisiana coast.
I'm in Port Fouchon, which is a beach and a port area right in the Gulf of Mexico. And right now I'm standing on the beach. There are lots of big sandbags that are here to protect the shore. And the water is very choppy. Right out in the water, I can see many dozens of production rigs and oil rigs that show that this is just the hub of the offshore oil industry in America. 90% of the rigs that are in the Gulf of Mexico are actually serviced from Port Fouchon, and somewhere between 15 and 20% of the oil that America uses comes through this area.
And what are you seeing there? Are you seeing any visible signs of the spill?
Well, this beach right in front of me, it's about a 12-mile-long beach, and a couple of days ago, it was covered with lots of globs of oil. It's what they call the tar balls. It's what's left over when a lot of the oil basically evaporates into the air. And we saw some of those tar balls at a laboratory that they had collected from here just a couple days ago, and they are just sticky brown goo balls.
Elizabeth, are you hearing whether any parts of the spill have reached other parts of Louisiana's coast?
We were on another beach called Grand Isle just a couple minutes ago, and there were also tar balls coming on shore there, another island called Elmer Island. And they have found tar balls elsewhere, on not just on Louisiana's coast, but some of the other states' coasts as well.
Elizabeth, we're hearing some reports, and it's hard to know how accurate they are, that some people in New Orleans and along the coast can actually smell chemicals in the air. Have you noticed any of that?
We haven't smelled chemicals, but I have spoken with both researchers and people who've smelled these smells, and some of them, the smells are coming from the oil and from the sheen on top of the water, and the winds right now are very strong. They're bringing the sea air in towards us. We don't happen to smell them, but other people do, and people can become nauseous from the smells, and they report headaches. And so far, the Environmental Protection Agency says that they have not reached levels that are harmful to people's health.
Elizabeth, I think I'm hearing some sounds behind you. Can you give us an update on where the cleanup is right now as we speak?
Well, actually, we are at a place where there's not cleanup going on, but there is a furious effort by National Guard troops to try to block up some of the holes in this island so that the oil doesn't get through those holes into the very fragile wetlands that are behind us. So if you imagine, these islands are long, skinny stretches of sand that protect the marshes. And because of the fierce hurricanes that hit this area, there are channels cut through these islands. And so these guard troops are busy with bulldozers and dump trucks full of rocks trying to plug those holes.
That's NPR's Elizabeth Shogren in Port Fouchon, Louisiana. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Guy.
17 children have been murdered in their schools in China over the past 2 months. Nearly 100 have been wounded. The deadliest attack occurred just this week when a man with a kitchen cleaver ran into a kindergarten in Hanzhong and hacked 7 children to death, along with their teacher and her mother. He left another 18 children wounded before returning home and killing himself. You have to be careful about seeing a pattern in what may be isolated incidents. But even though China has greatly reinforced security at schools across the country, a number of Chinese seem eager to blame a government that could not keep tainted infant formula off grocery shelves, or explain why at least 5,000 children died when so many poorly built schools collapsed during the 2008 Sichuan earthquake. The death of any child is impossible for a parent to bear. But imagine the loss of a child in a place in which most families are forbidden to have more than one child. Despite the threat of repression and censorship, some Chinese are speaking out. Xi Chuan, editorial writer for the Daobao newspaper, posted a fierce column that contended school attacks occur because people in China are forbidden any real outlet to express opinions, vote for change, or vent frustrations. After being treated unfairly or being bullied by authorities, he wrote, and unable to take revenge on those government departments that are safeguarded by state security forces, killers have to let out their hatred and anger on weaker people. I'd be wary of anyone using that logic to explain any of our U.S. school shootings, so I am skeptical about assigning it to school killings in China. But I've never been a citizen of a country that so absolutely suppresses its own citizens. In the U.S., people blame school massacres on pop culture, lax gun laws, negligent parents, violent games, or bloodthirsty music. In China, everything traces back to the government. Maybe more significantly, the newspaper criticized the government's attempts to censor news of the school attacks, which has nevertheless spread around China. It is undeniable that the media's coverage on these incidents of bloodshed may inspire potential killers, the editorial said, but it will educate more people by raising awareness of self-protection and spur the authorities. China has exploded over the past generation. Millions of people have been uprooted, raised up, and smacked down. A British medical journal estimates that more than 173 million Chinese suffer some kind of mental illness. Only 9% receive any kind of counseling or therapy. Millions more go to astrologers and consider mental illness a Western weakness. I don't want to confuse acts of murder with cries for help, but no matter how rich China gets, millions of Chinese can only feel trapped in a vast, brutal machine. And when children start dying, some people will want to break it down. You're listening to NPR News.